the volume.
The Colin Cowherd Podcast brought to you by FanDuel. It's never been easier to play fantasy on FanDuel. Whether you love basketball, golf, soccer, or any fantasy sport, there is a contest for every fan. FanDuel, more ways to win. Hi, everybody, and welcome to my Wednesday morning podcast. Well, I thought I'd bring an old friend on to kind of look in the rearview mirror of what we just witnessed. And Greg Cosell, as you know, has been working for over four decades at NFL Films. And I have a feeling he is going to be a regular as often as we can grab him on the volume and may even be compensated, which, good Lord. Oh. That's always a bonus.
Wow, that would be a good thing, Colin.
Yes. So I'm going to tell you what struck me, because I actually watched this Super Bowl from a hospital bed on Saturday or on Sunday. So, you know, a lot was made of the weapons and Brady and the turbulence in coaching and Todd Bowles and the front. But we didn't spend a lot of time talking about the offensive line. And if you look at, say, Ali Marpet, who had come out from Hobart, 13th rated guard out of college, and then 12th, 13th. And then Jensen had been a very solid center, and Tristan Wirfs was, of course, a rookie right tackle. This was never, in my opinion, an elite offensive unit, Greg. And then as I sat and watched the Green Bay game and the Chiefs game, I thought to myself, okay, either they've made a significant leap as an offensive unit, or there is something here Brady is synthesizing with this group. Now, this is where I really lean on you.
Right.
I've never thought of this offensive unit as elite, but I thought over the last eight quarters of football, and again, this is something maybe Tom can do pre-snap. Maybe this is Tom off the bye week. It looked to me in that game as if their offensive line cohesively was an elite force. That's what my eyes told me. What did the film tell you with that front over the course of a season?
Well, let me speak to the Super Bowl, Colin, because I think there was a big sense in the Super Bowl that they dominated.
Yeah.
And I think tactically they were able to do so for this reason. Because their defense played so well, and the Chiefs never really scored and got to the point where the Bucs had to play any differently than their game plan. And their game plan was this. They wanted to play at a base personnel, meaning two tight ends, three tight ends, six offensive linemen. Joe Haig, the sixth offensive lineman, played over 20 snaps in the game. Think about that. Now, the reason that's important, Colin, is because what did we all think going into this game? That Steve Spagnuolo was going to blitz and it was going to be a problem, right? It wasn't that sort of what we all thought. I know,
yeah.
I did. I thought it would be a problem. But the large majority of Steve Spagnuolo's blitzes come from their sub packages, nickel and dime, five defensive backs, six defensive backs. So when the Bucs were able throughout the course of the game to pretty much stay, not every snap, of course, but to pretty much stay with base personnel, they got the Chiefs in their base personnel. And the pressure schemes from Steve Spagnuolo don't come out of his base personnel packages. So the Bucs were able to run their offense without that much worry about pressure. And then you could get into the run game. You could get into the quick rhythm pass game where the pass rush is not a factor at all because the ball comes out. Think of that 25-yard completion to Gronkowski. I forget exactly when that was in the game, but that almost looked like the Patriots with the bang play action and the ball coming out. So the Bucs were able to play with base personnel through much of the game because their defense allowed them to do that.
I talked to Mark Schlereth this week, and he said he had talked to Brady before the Detroit Lions game. That was a blowout win.
Right.
And Arians and Brady both agreed that Tom is most effective pre-snap,
yes,
and Arians' offense is often post-snap.
Great point.
And that's what I thought. And Schlereth said the two of them acknowledged it was in that bye week when they could melt them into each other. Now acknowledging, and I want you to talk to our audience about that, about, because I thought it sounded so interesting to me that what Brady did and Arians did, it really took a lot of work. There was a lot of turbulence in this, Greg, and kind of explain that, what the film said.
Yeah. Well, that's a great point that Schlereth made, and obviously Brady knew that. I'm sure he knew that going there because everybody knows what Bruce Arians' offense is. Bruce Arians' offense is a top-down offense. He wants on almost every pass play, almost, nothing's 100%, to have a deep vertical option that if the defense presents itself in such a way, you have the ability to go over the top. Carson Palmer can talk about this all day long, being in that offense. And obviously, Carson Palmer was a big-armed quarterback. Brady was more used to a quick-rhythm timing offense. Now, Brady was always so good before the snap of the ball, he knew where he was going before the snap. But there were still elements post-snap with Brady's offense in New England because there was a lot of what we call choice routes, option routes, where the receiver would have to read the leverage of defenders. Now, a lot of times they did know that before the snap of the ball, but Brady knew he could get the ball out quick. Arians' offense is a little different. The ball does not necessarily come out quick. And that's why there were games this year before it all kind of melded where Brady would get hit a lot and get sacked a lot because there was, I think, a little bit, it was anathema to him that, what do I do here? Because I'm used to getting the ball out, but there's a lot of opportunities, potential opportunities for big plays that are built into this offense, into the Bruce Arians offense. And I think they were able to mix and match. That play I spoke about, the Gronkowski play, as I recall now, it came on the first touchdown drive of the third quarter. That was vintage Patriots. And I think they built more of that into the offense because Brady was very comfortable with that without losing the big play element when appropriate.
When, you know, when you watch that game, Kansas City had been such a wonderful come from behind team.
Yes.
And often Belichick in big games, he gave you a blueprint how to stop, for instance, the Rams in the Super Bowl. And many teams have seen Belichick's blueprint and stolen parts of it. I look at the ability to stop Travis Kelce in the Super Bowl. Is there anything Tampa did, Todd Bowles, that other teams could take next year, Greg, and say, you know, Tampa did a couple things in the Super Bowl, which may be little slight blueprints going forward, or was it just a personnel match? Was it a personnel fit? Was it a lack of protection from a Mahomes issue? Was there anything Tampa did that really did, in actuality, give the Chiefs schematic troubles?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there, Colin. Let's talk about what they did schematically, and then we'll talk about Mahomes. What they did essentially schematically were three things. Now, again, there are a few other things they did, but essentially three things. In their nickel, five defensive backs, they played a lot of what we call two-man coverage. Two deep safeties, man-to-man across the board, and they put Lavonte David on Travis Kelce.
And he's a good matchup. He's quite an athlete.
Right, but if you said that before the game, you'd say, hey, Kelce's great, not a great matchup, right? Wouldn't that be the normal response?
Yeah, Kelce's a nightmare for everybody.
Right, and then David, as good as he is still a linebacker. But when you play two-man, you've got help over the top on both sides of the field. So what did David do? He got physical with Kelce. He didn't just let Kelce free release, free access, get into his routes cleanly. He got very physical with him both at the line of scrimmage and through the first 5 yards, disrupting the timing because he knew if Kelce happened to get over the top of him, there's a safety. There's two safeties over the top. That's what they did out of nickel. Out of dime, they went with a specific concept. They started with three safeties across, three deep safeties across, and a five-man front, okay? They played what essentially was a 3-2-6 dime. Three down linemen, they kept David and White on the field. Then when the ball was snapped, they spun the coverage, and it essentially became single high with kind of a cover three matchup feel to it. And sometimes they would rush five, but they kept the two linebackers on the field for the athleticism. Nothing that reinvented the wheel, but a nice change up from what they had done during the season. And then the third thing they did, which we all expected, was they played a lot of split safety, where they kept two safeties relatively deep. And then when the Chiefs lined up with Kelce as the single receiver to the short side of the field, something the Chiefs had done exceptionally well all year, and yep. more than any team in the league, by the way.
Yeah.
What they did is they kept a corner on him, and they had the corner match him man to man. So they played what we call cover four lock. They locked the corner on Kelce. And that's a good matchup because big corners. It was either Dean or Davis. Two big physical corners. So that's essentially what the Bucs did. So it wasn't anything we've never seen before. Can other teams do it? Have other teams done it? Yes. It worked in this game for a couple of reasons. Number one, the pass rush. And number two, Mahomes, and the tape tells you this. We can't sit here because people can't see this, Colin. I can't show you five plays, you know, but Kurt Warner, in a sense, did. And we saw the same things. Mahomes started playing a little fast right from the beginning of the game. In fact, on the first series, he rushed a throw to Hardman versus Dean. Hardman got on top of Dean, but Mahomes threw it way too early and with poor ball location. He was already rushing himself. It was the wrong throw. It was too flat. It was too far inside. Now, there was real pressure in this game, but there were also four or five plays that were there to be made that Mahomes did not make.
The next time you're watching basketball, I've got the perfect way for you to get in on the action for free. I'm talking about NBA InPlay, absolutely free to play on the FanDuel app, and features all the fun of live betting. NBA InPlay turns every quarter of every game into a free contest where you can win real cash prizes. So while you're watching the game, all you have to do is predict the outcomes of plays and game props before they happen to claim your share of the prize pool. Best of all, a new contest starts every quarter of every game, giving you even more ways to win. FanDuel is the exclusive home for NBA InPlay, so the action is always available right at your fingertips on the FanDuel app. The app is easy to use. It takes less than 2 minutes to sign up. I did. It's a breeze. And it doesn't matter where you live or where you're traveling to, because NBA InPlay is available in every state. Don't miss your shot. Get in the game and download the FanDuel app to start playing NBA InPlay today. Good Super Bowl look back by Greg Cosell on the Colin Cowherd podcast on Wednesday. By the way, we love when you sign up for this at The Volume Sports. Subscribe, rate, and sign up. We love to have you here. All right, I'm going to give you just a couple of random thoughts, and okay. You can take your hatchet to it. Okay. If you look at the last 3 years of Mitch Trubisky's resume with Matt Nagy, his numbers are better than Baker Mayfield and similar to Goff. I am not insinuating he's better than either. But what it makes me think about, his passer rating was 90 last 3 years, 65% completion percentage, 2-1 touchdown to interception. It makes me think that Matt Nagy is actually a quite excellent coach who, with one receiver, Allen Robinson, Tariq Cohen hurt, one running back, and a middling offensive line, is a hell of a coach. And that a Carson Wentz to a Chicago, and they're in the running now for him,
right,
could be a really interesting marriage. That we're forgetting here, we so love to criticize Trubisky, that we're not acknowledging that for an average thrower, he had close to Matt Ryan numbers without much to work with, and that Nagy to this point is an undervalued coach. Right, wrong, out of my mind. What do you think when I say that?
Well, I think numbers are numbers, okay? Because you have to look at what Trubisky's strengths and limitations are. When you watch the tape of Trubisky, what you ultimately see, Colin, is a quarterback that struggles in the gray areas. In other words, it needs to be really clearly defined for him to be comfortable. Okay, now you can do that at some points in every game. You can be proactive, you can define reads, you can define throws. You can't do that on every play. And that's where Trubisky always struggles. And he's not an overly accurate thrower. His ball placement is erratic. So when you combine those two things, you have a quarterback that's almost a snap-to-snap player, depending on down and distance, field location, game situation. And then he becomes week to week because of that. So you can try, to control him, and you can try to channel him and rein him in, but you can't totally do that. So the limitations will always come out. They come out in some games more than others. They tend to come out in the games that matter more because you're playing better teams. Now, he does have legs and he can move, but there's a limitation to him as a passer. And believe me, that coaching staff knows that. Wentz is a really difficult challenge for me because what he was this year was really tough to see. Things that made him really good, and coming off 2017 and even for another year or so after that, things that made people think he was a top five quarterback in the league were gone this year. He didn't see things clearly. He didn't turn it loose when things were there, when the design of the play was there and the read was relatively basic. His accuracy, which was never pinpoint, he was never going to be Troy Aikman accurate. But this year, his ball placement really suffered. He's got mechanical issues that need to be fixed. And it's funny you mentioned Chicago, because when John DeFilippo, who's the quarterback coach in Chicago, was in Philadelphia, they really worked well together, and he fixed a lot of those issues. And now those issues have come back, and he's got clear mechanical issues. And that has to be the starting point, because his accuracy will never be consistent if you don't fix those issues.
All right, here's another somewhat contrarian take. That Deshaun Watson, for all the bellyaching about the dysfunction of Bill O'Brien in Houston, is a playmaker more than a pocket quarterback. And there is a sense that San Francisco is the perfect fit. Right. But I would argue, in what is mostly a run-first offense with a fairly rigid coach, that it would limit some of what Deshaun prefers doing and excels at doing, and that he's actually a better fit in a Carolina with a Matt Rule, where it is a little bit of a rebuilding offense. He is allowed to be a playmaker. And the idea that Deshaun to San Francisco is a perfect fit, I don't necessarily think it is.
Well, that's a fascinating discussion for this reason. Every team, every coach is system-based, Colin. No coach says to a quarterback, hey, we're just going to roll the ball out today and we want to see you run around and make plays. No one says that. Now, in the NFL, clearly, because defenses are very good, there are plays in games where the quarterback has to play outside the structure. And I think we all probably agree that it's very difficult. And let's put Tom Brady aside. It's very difficult now for a quarterback to be great if he doesn't have some kind of ability off script. It's very difficult. But you can't be off script too much. Deshaun is an interesting case study because I believe he's more than capable of playing from the pocket. And I thought he had a 6 or 7 game stretch this season where he played the best football of his career. And he played primarily from the pocket in that stretch. But he also is a quarterback that leaves the pocket prematurely and often creates his own pressure. Quarterbacks who leave the pocket prematurely will tend to create their own pressure, and it always makes it look like it's the offensive line's fault. And his history tells us that quarterbacks that leave the pocket prematurely get sacked more, get hit more. Russell Wilson, Deshaun Watson. Now, they make phenomenal plays, but your point's very interesting because Kyle Shanahan, he wants his quarterback to run his offense.
That's right.
He believes that his offense theoretically takes care of everything, and that there's a very, very low percentage of plays, very low percentage of plays in which the quarterback would have to run around. So that there's no way to know that because we don't know what's in Deshaun Watson's head, but I think your point is well taken.
Here's another take, is that there are many things you can teach a quarterback, but you can't coach reckless out of a player. And I say this as a father of six. Reckless early is reckless late. And that Marcus Mariota and Sam Darnold are very physical quarterbacks. And it is not, it is with reason they are often both dinged up consistently. And that you can't coach that out of Mariota, and you can't coach it out of Sam Darnold. And it will ultimately, regardless of where they land, limit both. They have the reckless gene. It will follow them forever. And it breaks my heart because I love Darnold, but I watched it this year, and he is a basketball player and a volleyball player in California from an athletic family, and he thinks he's a linebacker and he plays like it, that I think Darnold and Mariota, though both interesting talents, will always be limited.
Well, you and I spoke about Darnold, and I remember being out in L.A. with you when we had Clay Helton out there. And I spoke to him in your room, as a matter of fact. And I actually had my breakdown of Darnold, and I showed it to him. And it was when he was in college, obviously. And he agreed with me 100% because that bothered me about Darnold coming out, that there was a reckless, undisciplined looseness to Sam Darnold. And it's very hard to get that out of a player. Now, that it almost plays perfectly off our discussion of Watson, because quarterbacks who do that, they can make unbelievably special plays. And sometimes they make those plays when they shouldn't move out of the pocket, but they do, and they make those plays.
Right.
But there's a downside to that. And that downside, you really have to study every one of their plays like I do sitting and watching the coaching tape. Because when people watching a game see a quarterback move, Colin, they just assume he moves because he has to. That is not 100% the case. And very often it's not 60% the case. And Darnold is a guy that just has that knack of moving. And I'm not sure how well he sees the field when he moves. And I think for quarterbacks that have that tendency like Darnold, if when they move and they don't see the field real well, that's why he throws those interceptions where we all scratch our head and say, who are you throwing it to? And he has too many of those. Now, I don't know if that's fixable or not. Mariota is a little different because Mariota is not a big arm guy. He's not a power thrower. Darnold has a bigger arm. Mariota is a kind of a more silky mover. It's just the way his body type, because he's thinner. He's not built like a linebacker, but he's not a great thrower. And he's another guy where I don't want to necessarily compare him exactly to a Mitchell Trubisky, but I think he's another guy where it has to be really well defined for him to be successful.
All right. Here's another outside the box quarterback take, is that because the heart of college football is overwhelmingly in the South and secondarily the Big Ten, not that we ignore players from the West, certainly not USC, but we often do Oregon or Washington players. And when I look at Justin Herbert and I take into consideration the ease of which he throws, the size of his body, never truly been hurt, the strength of his arm, a 4-point-plus GPA, but he goes to Oregon, that he's actually potentially a greater talent than Trevor Lawrence, a bigger, thicker, stronger arm talent than Trevor Lawrence. But, and remember, the Chargers offensive line is probably the, well, it is the weakest unit on that team. And when you consider what he was asked to do without a preseason behind that offensive line, we are looking at somebody that throws the ball with almost the ease of a Marino. It is just a natural, easy, almost a Thanksgiving with the family talent, that he's really much more special than a lot of people realize. And he may be a greater talent than Lawrence.
I don't think that's a hot take at all, Colin. If you remember, I asked you that about 7 or 8 weeks ago. who's more. And keep in mind, he was throwing to receivers named Johnson and Guyton, too, for a number of games that nobody had heard of. So to me, Herbert is a big, big time talent. Now, he had a couple of issues coming out that we all saw.
What were yours? What did you see that you didn't like?
Two things stood out to me, and I studied him for two seasons, not just his last
I know
season.
You did, because you told me we talked about this the year before he came out.
Right. I thought that his ball placement was a little erratic.
It was.
Which turned out not to be the case for the most part this year with the Chargers. And I thought that he didn't have any kind of refined sense of timing and anticipation, that he was what you would call a see-it, throw-it quarterback. That was not a big issue, and I give a ton of credit to that coaching staff for that. But he's a bigger man than Trevor Lawrence. He's an easier thrower.
Yes.
Than Trevor Lawrence.
Yes.
We can sit and debate arm strength. Lawrence obviously has a very, very good arm. I would argue that Herbert's arm is naturally more powerful, but Lawrence has no issues with arm strength. I think Herbert is more purely physically gifted than Trevor Lawrence. Now, having said that, I don't want people listening to this thinking that I don't think Lawrence is a really good prospect. Of course, Lawrence is a really good prospect, and I've already evaluated him. I watched him last summer from 2019. I've done 9 games already, probably way too many, but you know me, Colin, I get lost in this stuff, and I just keep watching and watching. Plus, they got a bunch of receivers that I had to see in great detail as well. But no, I don't think that's a hot take. I think Herbert is physically more gifted.
All right, so we've addressed the Super Bowl. I've given you my 4 or 5 slightly contrarian pro quarterback takes. So I'm going to do, because I want to bring you on again, and we're going to delve into the draft at a later date.
Right.
But I do want to address Trevor Lawrence.
Okay.
Give me something that needs work. Something that you lack, look at and you think to yourself, hey, this needs work.
I think he needs work versus pressure. And when I say pressure, I don't mean blitz pressure. Where is it coming from? I mean when the pocket gets muddied and noisy. He has a tendency, and we saw it last year in 2019 in the playoffs. We saw it this year in the playoffs. He tends to really hurry his mechanics and rush himself, and he loses his accuracy. And I think he also needs some work related to this with his movement within the pocket to avoid and reset. Now, he can do that. It's not as if he's incapable or we've never seen it, Colin, but I think those are two areas that he needs work, because he definitely tends to rush his mechanics, and then he loses his ball placement, because he's a pretty naturally accurate thrower. He does not have issues with scattershot. He's not that guy at all. But he's not a wind-up thrower, but he's almost like it's funny that we're playing off the Herbert conversation. He's kind of a full body thrower. You know, it sounds like I'm talking about wine, but he's kind of a full body thrower, not just a, you know, turn it loose arm guy. Like Herbert's much more of a just turn it loose
yes.
arm guy, and it just comes out. Lawrence has a little bit more of his body involved in his throw. And therefore, if he feels that there's people around him and that he has to get it out, everything gets a little rushed. And I think that's something that can be worked on and can be cleaned up, but I think it does need to be worked on.
Is it potentially because he so rarely faces pressure at Clemson?
Yes. It's a great point. And he faced pressure in some of those big games.
That's right.
Yes. And he started to rush himself. Like I said, over the summer, I think I watched 8 games from 2019, and I've been through, I think, almost every game he's played this year, because he missed a couple due to COVID. So I think I've been through every game that he played this year, maybe with the exception of one. And very rarely was he under pressure. But it reminds me, and I'm not making comparison of quarterbacks. I'm making comparison of how I do my work. It reminds me of when Blaine Gabbert came out. And he played in Missouri in that spread offense where there are so many one-step throws, okay? And I had to keep looking for throws where he was under pressure, because there were very few. And I found enough, and I saw that he does not handle pressure at all. And that was his downfall in the NFL right from year one with Jacksonville. You would get people anywhere near him, and he would rush and make ill-advised, inaccurate throws. Now, again, I don't want people to think I'm comparing the quarterbacks. It's about the process of studying. You have to find those plays, because in the NFL, Trevor Lawrence will be under pressure.
Yeah, you want to know, interesting story. So when I used to take emails during my show, so it was before the Blaine Gabbert draft, and I got an email from a fan. He said, hey, listen to you forever. It almost looked like a scouting report. He goes, Blaine Gabbert is going to be a huge bust. I'm a Missouri season ticket holder.
Right.
And if I recall, the game he threw out was against Nebraska. Ndamukong Suh may have been playing at some point. I forget. But Nebraska had a fairly intense pass rush. And he said he literally became so discombobulated with pressure. He said, I've watched every snap for Missouri. Any interior pressure, he loses total confidence. And I remember that email because I remember halfway through Gabbert's rookie year thinking, I've got to find that email. It's the greatest email I've ever received. And to your point, I had an NFL general manager tell me years ago that all NFL players can dominate physically in high school, and many can dominate physically in college. That the NFL is the first place you are hit by an equal man or greater, and that some kids just don't respond to it. They don't like to be hit. The bully finally gets hit. And there's just a lot of players. You know, Blaine Gabbert was probably a great high school player. He goes to Missouri. He doesn't get hit. Matt Leinart had a little bit of this, where Matt was rarely uncomfortable. And when he got hit in college, it rattled him. So to your point, I think that is something actually, Greg, that you spot very early with NFL players. That you can see, you can give me an example or two. I've seen players and I think he is not comfortable being hit.
Yeah, and Lawrence is a much higher level traits prospect than Blaine Gabbert. I mean, Gabbert was a big guy with a big arm, but Lawrence has much more in terms of all the traits. But, you know, that Clemson offense, and this is what you learn watching the tape, which is why I watch every play of all these games, Colin. I'm not just watching highlights. I'm watching every play on the coaching tape. That was a very highly schemed offense. There were a lot of one-read throws. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's college football. You know, Dabo Sweeney's job is to win games at Clemson. Okay? Yes, he got the best quarterback in America coming, you know, from Georgia in Lawrence. And, you know, he's going to be the number one pick in the draft. And he will likely have a really good NFL career. But I think we have to be careful about assuming that guys come in the league, particularly at the quarterback position, as finished products. It's not a knock on the player. They're just not finished products because the college game is not the NFL game.
You ask much more from the position, simply put.
Correct. And I've been around. I don't know. Have you been around Trevor Lawrence? He's an unbelievable kid. I've been around him. He's just a terrific kid. He's a worker. It's very important to him. He'll figure all this out. I'm just making the point that here's what the tape shows, and this is what has to be worked through when he gets to the highest level of competition.
Now, finally, because I'm going to bring you on again before the draft, and I believe compensation could be key.
My people will talk to your people.
So let me just throw this out. I had an NFL general manager tell me last week, there's a lot of good players, but the talent drops off midway through the fourth round. He said it's a very good offensive tackle draft, a very good wide receiver draft. There's some really special corners. When you're looking at tape, your thoughts on areas you like and, you know, your thoughts on 4.5 rounds, not that it dries up, but there's a talent drop off.
Well, since I'm, you know, it's just a week or so after the Super Bowl and I'm just really digging in now. Let me just comment on your offensive tackle thing, because two points I would make there. And then we'll talk more about, you know, when we do another one of these is you always hear now about right tackle, left tackle. I think that delineation is meaningless in today's NFL. I think that the game has dramatically changed to the point where there's a lot of quick game, number one. Okay, so the ball comes out. And number two, the way defenses are structured now with pressure schemes and what they do defensively to attack the quarterback, it's not like it was 20 years ago. The right tackle and the left tackle, to me, are the same. So if a guy is a left tackle in college, and then I'm going to make one more point, I don't buy into, well, he's a right tackle in the NFL. So in other words, you'd rather have him face Von Miller. That's okay. You know, I mean, to me, that delineation doesn't matter anymore. And secondly, the other thing you hear about tackles in college is they don't have great feet, so they have to be moved to guard. Well, in that case, you'll have no left tackles because, you know, there's not 100 Joe Thomases out there. You know, a lot of these guys don't have sweet feet. Right. They're not all dancing bears, but they can play tackle in the NFL. Now, maybe they'll get beat once in a while with a speed rush that, you know, they don't handle. But otherwise, we'd have three guys in a draft that are technically tackles and everybody else would be a guard. So we have to step away from this idea that you have to have the sweetest feet of all to play tackle in the NFL, because otherwise there'd be no tackle prospects.
And with that, we want to thank Greg Cosell. Remember to follow us on social media at The Volume Sports on Twitter and at The Volume Sports on Instagram. Rate, review, and hit that subscribe button wherever you listen to podcasts. Okay, Greg, this has been great. An extended 35, 36-minute Greg Cosell podcast. Absolute pleasure. And enjoy the tape. You're going to be deep diving on it for the next 6 to 8 weeks. That's all you'll do, right?
That is correct, yes.
All right. Well, good talking to you.
Thanks, Colin. Appreciate it.
The volume.